Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 4th of January 2012 here in Japan, and it is still the 3rd of January on the west coast of Canada, where I'm joined on the line by our regular guest, Dr. Tim Ball of DrTimBall.com. That's DrTimBall.com. So, Dr. Tim Ball, it's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us once again in 2012.
Well, thank you, and we launch into a new year, and hopefully it's going to be a very interesting year as a pivotal year.
I certainly hope it will be a pivotal year in a good sense, but of course there could be the other sense in which it could be a pivotal year. But thinking about some of the topics that we've often talked about in the past and some of the topics that we've broached in our last conversation, perhaps we can talk a little bit about why 2012 is going to be such a pivotal year.
Well, of course, a lot of people are talking about it as a pivotal year because there's all the doomsayers out there that say the Mayan calendar ends in December of 2012, and therefore that's going to mark the end of the world. The problem with any calendar is it's got to stop somewhere, and so that's where they just happen to end it. But people, as I said, are picking up on that. I think that if there is anything that is potentially devastating at the end of 2012, it will be what happens in the U.S. election as to which direction the U.S. is going to go. But there is an event in South America that is pivotal for the year, and that is what's being called Rio Plus 20. And, of course, this is an attempt to revitalize the 1992 Rio conference, which was really the beginning of the exploitation of the environment and climate as a vehicle for a political agenda. And, of course, a major part of 1992 Rio was Agenda 21, which is essentially a manifesto of the whole concept of sustainable development. And Rio Plus 20, they list the objectives of their conferences. It says the conference will focus on two themes: a green economy in the context of sustainable development and poverty eradication, and B, the institutional framework for sustainable development. Well, of course, the what's amusing about that is that sustainable development comes back up again, that term that was created by a politician, Gro Harlem Brundtland, in her report to the Club of Rome. And sustainable development became a nice political words that mean everything to everybody and nothing to anyone. That's part of the goal. Poverty eradication, of course, all very nice and makes it look like a good objective. One could be cynical and quote the Bible and say that the poor will always be with us. But I would suggest that the poor are generally better off worldwide than they were even 20 years ago. And so anyway, Rio Plus 20 is an attempt to revitalize what we've been experiencing for the last 20 years. Now, the 1992 Rio conference was organized by the United Nations Environment Program through the efforts of Maurice Strong, who we've talked about many times on your program. And, of course, he's he was the master developer of bureaucracies to perpetuate a political agenda. And so he had two prongs to what went on. One was through the United Nations Environment Program. One was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which he organized through the World Meteorological Organization, because that then gave him access to every world weather agency, because they were the ones that appointed people to the IPCC. And, of course, they were the ones that directed virtually all the funding in climate research to proving the hypothesis rather than disproving it. In other words, they were the ones that created the science, the climate science that Strong needed to support his political agenda. And then the 1992 Rio conference was where he took that corrupted climate science idea into the public and political arena through and the creation of non-government organizations, NGOs, and extreme environmental groups and so on. And I think there were two measures for me of Rio. One was that you had keynote speakers like David Suzuki's young daughter. I believe she was 13 at the time. And the other was that George Herbert Bush refused to attend, said that it was simply a political exercise. And so Rio Plus 20, an attempt to revitalize sustainable development and perpetuate the idea that of the ideas of the Club of Rome, that the world population, particularly with the aid of capitalism and development and technology, is destroying the planet, and so it's failing in just 20 short years. I mean, the fact that their manifesto says that the green economy, but everywhere it's been tried, the green economy has been a complete failure. And so it's going to be a very interesting retrospective of Rio, and I think it's important that a lot of people that realize what's gone on, people like myself, explain to people, this is what they set out to do, and this is what's actually happened, and it's been devastating, and more of the same isn't going to make it any better. And so it's pivotal year for that reason. Now, one of the things, James, with Agenda 21 is that it is, of course, the objective of one world government. It is the objective of income equity, redistribution of wealth, penalizing those that have been successful and have developed and improved the quality of life for everybody in the world. And it's to punish them for their sins, particularly, and this was the idea of Kyoto, which of course is now virtually dead, was to punish those that produce the CO2 in order to get ahead and become wealthy, that they had to pay for their sins by paying to the underdeveloped countries who supposedly were suffering from the climate change that they had created. Now, the other thing that's interesting that's happened very, very recently was that the Canadian government announced that it was withdrawing from Kyoto. It gave us the main reason, the fact that if they stayed in, they would have had to pay, and I refer to them as indulgences rather than carbon credits, because that's exactly what they are, that they would have had to pay $12 to $14 billion into the fund to these developing nations, and it simply couldn't afford it. Now, what's hypocritical about that is everybody picked it up and said, oh, good, Canada's in the forefront, and they've withdrawn from Kyoto. Kyoto was going to die at the end of 2012 anyway, and many other nations had already basically withdrawn or simply not acted at all, and Japan is a good example. So it wasn't going anywhere. The hypocrisy of it is that even the Canadian government intend to continue funding the climate research and to come up with a replacement for Kyoto that's more acceptable, that is, that doesn't cost them as much money. In other words, they haven't understood that the problem isn't the political vehicle that they've created and the Kyoto and the cap and trade. It's the fact that it's based on completely false science. And the Canadian government are simply, not acknowledging that, as are none of, or I don't know of any other government that is acknowledging that. The only one that did was Václav Klaus of the Czech Republic. So we're in a very interesting situation, as I said, with Canada looking like it's being a leader, but in fact, it's just showing that it's ignorant of the scientific facts. So the climate issue is a dead issue with the public. Whenever you see polls with upcoming elections, even environment, has pretty well fallen off the list of public concerns, partly because of the economic situation, but also because of the failed predictions, the scare tactics that were, you know, this is going to happen and that's going to happen. I mean, if you go back to 1968 and look at what Paul Ehrlich was saying about how, you know, Britain would be completely gone by the year 2000, effectively gone by the year 2000, and the millions of people, in fact, yeah, hundreds of millions of people would be starving to death by 1970. So all of those things. Then the colder weather, of course, has made people raise questions. And so what we're going to see, I think, what will happen at Rio Plus 20 is a retrenchment by simply sidling away from the climate issue, and I think that you'll see a reduction in the importance of the IPCC, but it will refocus on two other of the major objectives of Agenda 21 and the Club of Rome.
I think you're exactly right on that point. In fact, it's something that I've been observing more and more recently, is that they have been, to a certain extent, backing away from the climate alarmism, but I've seen a renewed interest in ideas of sustainable development and other such, as you say, touchy-feely phrases that can mean anything that anyone wants it to mean. And unfortunately, the people who were behind the original Rio were the ones who drafted Agenda 21, which, as you point out, is really just a treatise for world government and for all sorts of new ways for government to intervene in our daily lives and basically take over the world in the name of the environment. So I very, very much see this going in that direction. But it, of course, begs the question then, if they are going to back away or at least stop promoting the climate alarmism as much as they have been, what is going to take its place as the alarmism that they can use to scare the public into submission once again?
Yeah, well, of course, some of the climate alarmism is continuing, but it isn't occurring through the through the UN agencies as much, or through national governments as much. It's more coming from universities and groups that have been getting very large amounts of climate funding, and of course they're squealing. It's also coming from corporations who have put a lot of money into alternate energies and other things because of government grants and potential business opportunities. So they're still, arguing about CO2 in the atmosphere. I just saw an ad for Mercedes the other day for a car that they said had very low CO2 emissions, as if that was of any importance to anybody. And so there are still some residual effects of what the government did and what the Rio 20 or Rio 92 did, but yeah, the shift will be back to two major themes. One is, of course, the original objective, which was that the world is overpopulated. Now, the Club of Rome, of course, elaborated that by saying, and the original idea, of course, Malthusian idea of the 19th century, was that the population would outgrow the food supply. Well, that idea basically has been, has been completely shown to be wrong. For example, the world produces enough food to feed 26 billion people. The problems are adequate storage of the food, better refrigeration, but also reduction of losses in transit, and then also efficient marketing systems, which we're just starting to click into place now. So that has gone, but they will go back to the population issue, because we just saw this last year the UN announced that the world reached 7 billion people. Well, this illustrates a lot of interesting things. One is, you can challenge them and say, how do they know? I mean, one of the standard exercises I had for the students in my political geography class was that in the first week, I wanted them to bring into the class whatever numbers they could find working alone on the population of Nigeria. and then the how much oil there was in Canada. And of course, what happens is when you start to dig into these numbers, you find that there's simply no substance to them at all. I remember we're back into the late 80s and early 90s, but that time you could find populations for Nigeria anywhere from 74 million up to 152 million. And of course, the problem is that the source of all of this data is the United Nations, but the United Nations relies on the data from the individual countries. And of course, they politicize it as much as they can, doctor the numbers however they want them. And another exercise I had the students do was to determine the population of Thompson, Manitoba, a sort of a mining community in northern Manitoba. Well, if you got the Chamber of Commerce number, you got one number. If you got the provincial budget office, you got a different number. If you got Stats Canada, you got a different number. Each of them, presumably, writing about the same place. And so Nigeria, on a world scale, it's no different. And just to illustrate the problem, you don't know if these numbers are correct unless something odd happens. For example, in the first census, I should say, in the United States that cost over $1 billion, it suddenly emerged that they had missed 12 million people. Now, the only reason that showed up, and that was to that point the most expensive census ever done, the reason it showed up was because when the checks came out from the federal government to the different regions, the Appalachian region suddenly discovered their checks were dramatically down. Well, the reason was because somehow 12 million of the population count hadn't got into the government computers, and the check that was cut was based upon the population size. But if it hadn't been for that, nobody would have caught the fact that 12 million people didn't get counted in the most expensive census in history. And then when you consider it, about the same time China did its first census, and I remember the statistics at the time where they were saying that in the 3 months that it took to do the census, the population of China increased by 17 million. And so, you know, you really start to wonder what's going on. And then to another example with UN statistics, I don't know if they still do it, but up until the last time I looked anyway, Cuba was listing literacy at 100%. Well, that's simply not physically possible, but these are the kinds of things that you're dealing with. And so the basic data, the basic numbers on population or anything else are essentially meaningless, yet they become the basis of myths and policy and all sorts of other nonsense that goes on. 7 billion plus or minus what? We don't really know. But the population is actually... Now the predictions are that it is declining, that the rate of increase has declined significantly, and some of the more realistic numbers suggest the world won't even make 9 billion. Now, of course, one of the concerns about that, and this is another part of this whole Agenda 21, Club of Rome influence, was that the first world conference on world population was held in 1994 in Cairo, Egypt, and one of the main people there and a major keynote speaker was Al Gore. And of course, I think they deliberately held it in Cairo, Egypt, because right outside the door you had evidence of overpopulation and malnutrition and poor economy and so on that goes with that. But of course, as I pointed out to the people, the country that had the highest population density in the world at that time was the Netherlands, and yet it had one of the highest living standards in the world. So the population issue continues to be a factor and that they will go back to. And it's interesting because I've had a lot of people. I remember old Charlie Keenan, who was an engineer, and he was very aware of what was going on with environmentalism and its exploitation for political gain. But and he didn't buy the whole global warming argument. But when you pushed him too hard, he would say, "But yeah, but of course I do think the overpopulation is a problem." So I had to sit Charlie down again and go through all of that. So Gore has made speeches about population being an issue again, and I have a little doubt that that will become a major part of the platform, because people get very, very uptight about overpopulation, about being overrun, about the idea. You see it in, for example, in the Soviet Union and or now Russia, where the white European Russians are afraid that the birth rate in their part of the population is below a replacement rate, and yet it's 3-4 times higher in the eastern part of Russia and amongst the Muslim population of Russia. So these sorts of fears are very vulnerable to being played upon for political gain. And so I think that we will see a great deal of that. And of course, one of the things that that needs to be said to counteract it is that the best way to reduce population is through capitalism and development. There's something, and I don't know if we talked about this before, but I've talked about it again. It's called the demographic transition. And this has been in the demographic literature for some time. One of the first countries where it was demonstrated was Sweden. And the demographic transition is that as your economy improves and people can afford retirement plans and can plan for the future economically, they tend to have fewer and fewer children. And because in developing countries and throughout history, the statistics on the number of children you had and then the number that survived that to become your support in old age are really quite incredible. I mean, there's a very good book by Antonia Fraser called The Weaker Vessel. It's about women's lot in the 16th and 17th century. And the average woman having something like 23 confinements in their lifetime. But of 23 children that were born, if two or three of them survived, you were lucky. I mean, Queen Anne, for example, had 19 children, and she outlived all of them. And yet she was wealthy. And so it wasn't a matter just of wealth. And so, of course, in the demographic transition, what happens is initially the people are living longer, and so the population tends to go up a bit, and then the birth rate starts to fall, and then the total population starts to reduce in numbers. But what happens is the population pyramid, which usually has a fairly broad base of younger people that are supporting a small peak to the pyramid, reverses itself. And you have this in Japan now, where you've got such a low birth rate that you're simply not replacing the number of people that are dying off. And so what you've got is an increasingly older population being supported by a smaller and smaller base, till eventually the pyramid just simply topples over. Now, some countries are trying to offset this. Italy is an example, regions, Quebec is an example, where they're rewarding families to have an extra child or two. And this has been going on for some time. Most other countries offset it by immigration, which simply masks and covers the problem and creates other tensions, as we see. Now, Canada is very cynical. Canada's amount of immigration is determined by what they think they need to keep the population base at a replacement level. And Now, that is generally conceded to be 2.4 children per family, but Quebec, for example, was down as low as 1.3 children per family. And so, of course, they tried to balance it out with immigration, but as happened in Quebec, what they saw was their desire for separation and a vote for separation amongst French Canadians was countered by what are called allophones, that is, non-French-speaking people. And of course, they couldn't then possibly win a vote to separate from Canada. So the dynamics of what is going on with the population issue are so distorted and so misunderstood by people, but nonetheless very, very vulnerable to exploitation by the Agenda 21 and the Club of Rome and so on. Now, the other thing that they did with the Club of Rome, they brought out the limits to growth in 1972. The first book, by the way, that was the driving force for the Club of Rome was Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. And of course, his population predictions turned out to be so grossly wrong, but he still got credibility. One of the interesting things with that is that a person that wrote articles and worked on books with Paul Ehrlich was John Holdren, who later went on to become a professor at Harvard and now is the science czar in the Obama White House. And so that's another reason that the population issue, particularly if Obama gets reelected, will become a major focus. Because Holdren, even though he was questioned about it in his hearings by the Senate, said, oh, no, he didn't hold the strong views that he used to hold. But nonetheless, as we know, the leopard doesn't change his spots. And, of course, these people were promoting abortion and eugenics and all sorts of other horrific things. And so that part of it, it is still very, very active in the Obama White House. But the other thing that happened with the Club of Rome was that they brought out the limits to growth, which was the very first time that a computer model had been used to forecast social, political and social trends with regard to population and resources. They were grossly simplistic models with simple trend and unidirectional trends, and they start from a certain point and say, okay, here's the amount of resource we've got now, and here's its cost, and it's just simply going to keep skyrocketing till it won't be long before we run out of that resource. And so that particular book established the pattern for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That is that you create these computer models that you build to guarantee a certain outcome. And then you just start plugging it in and it gives you the outcome. And then because people are so awed and overwhelmed by computers and models, they fall prey to this nonsense. Now, even though the limits to growth was very quickly shown to be wrong and challenged by an economist, Julian Simon, and that's worth looking up, by the way, James. Julian Simon challenged Holdren, and he said, not Holdren, but Ehrlich. He said, you pick out any minerals you want, and you pick out any time period, and I'll bet you that by the end of that time period, there'll be more of that material, that mineral available at a much lower price. Well, he took the bet, but then he got John Holdren to pick out the minerals and to pick out the time period. Well, of course, it was completely wrong, as I said, but that sort of slithered off into into the abyss. As to all of the failed predictions of these people, they continue to get the attention of the mainstream media and play the fear cards. And you have to wonder, at what point do your failed predictions bring you down? Now, in science, it should bring you down almost right away, because science is about prediction. If you can't predict, then your science theory and your science model and your science hypothesis are wrong. And the failure of these population predictions and economic predictions make a joke out of the idea that these are social sciences. They're not sciences at all. And but nonetheless, they continue to have sway. Now, they made a list in that in the limits to growth and the projections of the vehicles that they thought would be critical to swaying the public to the idea that we need one world government, we need income equity. We need to punish those who have taken advantage of the Mother Earth and the poor people to pay for their sins. And so climate was one, and of course we've seen that come and virtually go, as we discussed earlier. But the other one, of course, was the population. But as we work on getting the truth out about that, such as with the demographic transition, which shows that the best way to reduce population is to have capitalism and development. And then the third one, of course, is the water. Now, water was one of the earliest issues that got onto the UN agenda. Through Widmar Strong and through the work of the Club of Rome. And one of the principal people in that was Barbara Ward. Now, Barbara Ward was, she had been a minister, I think, of social services, if I remember correctly, under Harold Wilson's government in England. And she had got a little bit into trouble in England, because she made, I thought, what was actually a very sensible suggestion when she said, look, don't send a social worker with the welfare check, send an economist, because, or at least a money manager, because the people's problem isn't necessarily they don't have enough money, but they don't know how to manage the money they've got. And then there's an inevitably lot of good sense in that, but of course, in a socialist government that Wilson was running, that was simply unacceptable. But Wilson went off to the UN and was instrumental in, with René Dubé and a couple of other people, in creating the International Decade of Clean Water and Adequate Sewage, which was the decade of the 70s. And Ward was going around the world making comments like, you know, for the sake of $17 billion, you could provide adequate water and clean water and sewage to everybody in the world, which is very, very commendable and very, very true. But it doesn't work if you've got government doing it, and it doesn't work if you're trying to use it as simply a vehicle for another agenda. So that decade came and went. But now the water issue is starting to show up again, but in some very interesting ways. Now, let me stop at this point and say, well, okay, why is a climatologist, although obviously with the teaching courses in political geography, much wider interest, because my interest was always the impact of climate change on the human condition, I realized very quickly in my career that the forgotten variable was precipitation. All the focus was on temperature, and precipitation data is, if you think the temperature data is inadequate, the precipitation is even worse. They haven't got enough stations in the whole of Africa to even meet the minimum requirements of recording stations for precipitation. I also realized that droughts were the single most devastating climate event in history, not just for humans, but for all flora and fauna. And there was a very interesting thing that brought this home in the year 2000. when they asked 20 of the world's top climate and weather experts to list the 20 worst disasters of the 20th century, and I always wonder if you can have numerical alliteration, but they asked them to list the top 20, and it turned out that 11 of the top 20 were droughts. And interestingly, five of the remaining were floods. So, of course, what you see is that it's the extremes of precipitation in the short and the medium term and regionally that are much more problematic for flora and fauna and the human condition. So, of course, what that led me to do was to get interested in water as a resource. And I ended up teaching a water resources class for 25 years and got involved in water policy in Canada, water management, water law, water resources, the whole issue of water. One of my campaigns was, and I always used to push my students to support my campaign for changing the name of the planet from Earth to water, because it is unquestionably the most important resource. And when you look at NASA spending billions to go to other places, and the first thing they're looking for is water, with the mistaken assumption, of course, that you have to have water to have life, that's only true if you're talking about life as we know it. It doesn't mean to say there can't be some other form. But anyway, water, change the name of the planet. It is the one thing distinguishes this planet from all the others. And, of course, it is also one of the most important variables in climate. Because, as we discussed on your program here, James, water vapor, that is water in its gaseous form, is 95% of the greenhouse gases. But it's assumed to be constant and virtually ignored. And the focus only on CO2, because they wanted to keep the focus on temperature. Now, to show you how bad the science of the water issue is, the IPCC, in their predictions, say, oh, we're going to have global warming, and then they say there'll be more droughts. Well, that's counterintuitive, because if you have more higher temperatures, there's more evaporation, more moisture in the atmosphere, and therefore more potential rainfall, not less. But it's an illustration of how they twist the science to their political agenda. So the water issue is starting to appear from that Club of Rome, and I'm sure at Rio+20 we'll see it as a major part of the agenda and discussion. But it's also becoming a factor in many other ways. Because one of the phrases that we're starting to hear is the phrase that we heard with regard to the climate change issue. And it made strange bedfellows, because one of the arguments about fossil fuels was, you heard the term peak, that we were at the peak fossil fuels. And what they meant by that was that we were at the point of getting into more and more difficult oil to access and less oil available in reserve. So that peak oil became a term that was, and it was ironically valuable for the environmentalists, because they say, well, we should stop and switch to alternate before we run out, because we're going to run out inevitably anyway. But it also was an advantage to the oil companies, because they could say, oh, well, you know, it's costing us more because we're now accessing the more difficult oil, and therefore we're going to charge you more. So if you want a reverse of an old saying that politics makes strange bedfellows, here was peak oil making strange bedfellows of the oil companies and their nemesis, the extreme environmentalists. But what we're hearing, we're starting to hear now, and the phrase was brought forward, I first heard it about 2009, and that is peak water. The argument that we're running out of clean, potable, accessible water. And that, to me, was another red flag that water is going to become the next vehicle for the agenda for one world government and the Agenda 21.
I think that you are hitting on an extremely important subject here, and one that I haven't really been hearing talked about a lot, but I think you're exactly right that there has been this building momentum behind making water resources and water resource management the next theme by which the governments can find a way through environmental scares to get into the lives of ordinary people. And with all of these scares, there's always, there's a number of different agendas and things that converge, I think, quite nicely. But one of the main drivers in this, as always, of course, is the monetary concern. And with any suggestion of scarcity or somehow the management of a resource becoming important, it's always a question of who stands to benefit from it in a number of ways. But of course, financially being one of the key ones. So how about the world of water resource management? What types of financial interests are we talking about in this paradigm?
Well, fortunately, we've got some very good lessons from ancient Rome. When Rome was at its peak, water was the very fundamental resource in their civilization. I mean, the emperors prided themselves on building bigger and better aqueducts and bigger and better baths. And of course, so much of the terminology and the laws with regard to water and the economic patterns that we have for water were established by the Romans. And, of course, these now underlie our laws. There have been some modifications to them. We need to talk about that. But Rome also then provides us with a good object lesson in history of where these things are going and how to deal with them. Now, Rome had an advantage in that ultimately, when things got really out of hand, Augustus Caesar stepped in and just simply said, I'll handle out all the water rights and I'll control the whole thing. And he appointed a water commissioner by the name of Sextus Frontinus, who reported directly to him. Now, in some countries, of course, the control of the water lies with the central government, but it's normally... the best example is Israel. It's usually where you cannot be guaranteed of the source of your supply and protection of that source. And of course, Israel, to my knowledge, is the only country that has a very rigid national water policy. And nothing gets the final approval of anything that's done, whether it's agriculture, development, whatever, can we provide the water for it? Do we have the water for it? That's the final say. And of course, their problem was that the main supply of water was the Syria and Lebanon, which are not exactly reliable sources for Israel. And so they just simply said, okay, we've got the Sea of Galilee or Lake Kinneret, or Lake Tiberias, as the Romans called it. That's the major source of flow for the Jordan River that runs down into the Dead Sea. They do have a couple of very large aquifers of underground water, and during the excess rainy season, they store water in those aquifers. They actually pump the water into the ground. And of course, what they've also done, to the detriment of the Dead Sea, is built a national water carrier. This is a huge, I believe it's about 18-foot diameter pipe, down the west side of Israel that carries most of what would have gone in the Jordan River. As a result, the Dead Sea is getting saltier, although, of course, that's of barely noticeable significance. But Israel's the only country that I know of that has come face-to-face with a finite resource and the importance of it to the economy. One of the things that Margaret Thatcher got into trouble for, and this is, it might sound like I'm rambling around a little bit here, but sort of building some ideas. Thatcher sold off water rights. She allowed private companies to control the reservoirs and the distribution of water. And all the polls showed that at least 86% of the people were opposed to that. Now, that raises an interesting question, of course, because if we go back to the Roman idea, and I mentioned so many of our terms, like I already used the word aqueduct and spigot and all of these sorts of things, but the concept in Rome was that water was a public good, that you could buy water, and the amount you got was determined by how much you were willing to pay, and the amount you were willing to pay determined, in Rome anyway, how big a hole you could drill in the side of the aqueduct and where in the aqueduct you drilled it. So if you had a lot of money, you could drill a big hole at the bottom of the aqueduct because then you got a lot of pressure and a lot of flow. And of course, that concept is in virtually all Western civilization today, because you pay your water bill on the basis of the size of the pipe that's coming into your house, which sets a finite amount of water that you can get in any 24-hour period, and then the pressure within that pipe. And some cities control, to some extent, the amount of water that people are using by just simply reducing the pressure a little bit. It's not as easy as it, because, of course, with the demands on the water and the high-rise buildings and everything else. But it, you see the ideas. Now, what came out of the Roman idea with water, that water was a public good, and out of that came what are called through England and France as well, but mostly through England, what were called riparian rights. Now, the word riparian, you see, is another Latin word, means river, and it meant that everybody had rights to the water in the river, and everybody should have access to the river in order to be able to get access to the water. And that is the basis of the laws in countries like Canada and Britain. And up until the 20th century was the basis of law in the U.S. and Australia. Now, with riparian rights became what were called prescriptive rights. That is that if you weren't on a body of water and didn't have water in or near your property, you had to be allowed access to that water. Now, you can see this in many cities where, the one I was particularly familiar with in Winnipeg, where you had houses along the edge of the river with the prime properties, but every once in a while there was an access to the river for the people that lived across the road. And so this prescriptive rights, that is to provide for people that weren't directly on the water itself, was an extension of riparian rights, and of course, again, came from the Roman system. Now, I mentioned that the U.S. had that up until the turn of the 20th century, because what happened in the U.S. was, as they went west, and Horace Greeley said, "Go west, young man," the further west they went, the drier it got. And, of course, they got to California, the land of milk and honey, and they were determined to make it the land of milk and honey. And so they started some of the most massive irrigation projects in the world, particularly in Southern California. And we can talk about that and Imperial Valley later on. And irrigation, by the way, is one of the largest uses of water by humans throughout history and in the world. In fact, the most irrigated acres in the world are in India. And, of course, irrigation is also one of the earliest technologies of supposedly human advancement, according to the anthropologists. Now, it's interesting that three major advances in human history were of controlling the environment, or attempts to control the environment. The first one was fire, which allowed you to live in places that you couldn't normally live in, and allowed you to cook and eat meat that you wouldn't normally be able to eat. The other was, of course, clothing, which gave you a microclimate that allowed you to live in places you wouldn't normally be able to live. And then the third one was irrigation. And the earliest irrigation begins in the Tigris and Euphrates basin, which is now Iran and Turkey and Syria. And what happened there was that they were it was the Fertile Crescent. It was where agriculture, as we know it, sedentary agriculture began. But gradually, the climate got drier and drier. And as it got drier, then they introduced irrigation to provide the water when nature didn't provide it. And now that's an important point we can talk about later on. But it's interesting if you look at Baghdad today. Baghdad is about 200 miles inland, and 8,000 years ago it was on the coast, because one of the effects of the irrigation in that region is increased soil erosion and sediment transport to the coast. And you can see that in many parts of the world. When you look at the growth of the Ganges Delta as a good example, or the Nile Delta, another example, or even the Mississippi Delta. And irrigation then became a very important thing. But in the U.S., what happened was a clamoring for a change of the law with regard to water. And so they came up with what was called, and is around the turn of the 20th century, 1900, what was called appropriative doctrine. Now, that's generally shortened to prior rights, and that sort of gives you a better description of it. Now, prior rights basically says whoever is the first to use the water has the rights to it. And it's created some horrendous situations in the U.S., as you can imagine. We can talk about that later on, because there are lessons in that. So you now had two completely competing systems. The riparian prescriptive rights system, which says you don't own the water on your property, but you have the responsibility for it. That means that you can't pollute it, and that you must make it available to your neighbor. And if it's a river flowing through or a stream flowing through, you must pass on what is called the riparian flow to your neighbor. You can't stop the flow. Now, just to illustrate how this occurs bizarrely in cultures, there's a wonderful cartoon of Bugs Bunny standing under the waterfall, showering away and singing, and all of a sudden the waterfall starts to slow down and stops, and of course Bugs goes up on top, and here's a nasty Jean Lafitte, and he's built a great big dam. And of course Bugs blows it up and everything's happy again. But of course, you see, in Canadian or riparian or countries with riparian rights, he couldn't build that dam. And if he did, he would have to, he'd have a period of time to let the dam, the lake form behind the dam, but he'd have to maintain the riparian flow so Bugs would get his nice shower. Under prior rights, of course, if Jean Lafitte could show that he was the first to use that water, he could build the dam and Bugs would have to go dirty. So, now that sounds like an odd example, but, you know, if your kids are watching that kind of thing, I mean, they'll think about it at that level. But it's an illustration of just how pervasive these sorts of ideas can be in a culture. And, of course, when you look around the world, one of the things, and I'll come back to that riparian rights and appropriative rights a little bit later on, but when you look around the world, one of the problems for the world, and it's not a problem in any real sense, it just requires an awareness. Problems are only problems if you're not aware of them. But it is inequitable distribution. And, of course, this is one of the arguments about the Club of Rome as well. You know, God, well, we don't believe in God, but whoever nature created an inequitable system, and therefore it's us as government has to correct that. And of course, just disaster, as we've seen in all any attempts at it. But Africa is a very good example of the inequitable distribution, where you've got the whole center of the continent, with the Congo River and the Zambezi River and these massive river systems and incredibly heavy rainfalls of the tropics. And then you don't go very far on either side, and you're suddenly into desert. I mean, I talked about Nigeria earlier, and in fact, the conflicts that are going on there now with the Muslims from the north trying to impose Sharia law on the whole of Nigeria. In Nigeria, you go from the coast with 200 inches of rainfall a year on average, and by the time you get to northern Nigeria, Kano and places like that, you're down to less than 5 inches of rainfall. You're into the edges of the Sahara Desert. And, of course, the northern half of Nigeria is Muslim because of the influence of the Sahara Desert. And then the coastal regions are what they call Christian because of the colonial powers. And traditionally, they had a boundary between them, an area between them, that historically was literally called the Pagan Zone. Because it wasn't Muslim and it wasn't Christian. But what would happen is that as the droughts occurred in the southern part of the Sahara, in that region that's called the Sahel, and that became an area of focus back in the 1980s, then those people simply migrated into the wetter areas, and there was a buffer zone for them. Now, of course, you put political boundaries up, and you've put people that were normally kept or were apart and are suddenly now within the same country, and of course all the conflicts that arise from that. But Nigeria is a very good illustration of how rapidly you go from very heavy rainfalls in Africa to virtually the driest, some of the driest places on the planet, and certainly the Sahara, the largest desert in the world. And when you think about the Sahara, which is larger than Canada, and Canada is the second largest country in the world, you start to get an idea of what we're talking about in terms of lack of water supply. Now, in the south of in southern Africa, of course, you've got the Namib, Kalahari deserts and so on. And in fact, one of the great tragedies, I guess you could call it, or problems of colonialism was that the areas where there was water supply were taken over by the European colonials and the remainder left to the indigenous peoples. And you can see all sorts of illustrations of that. I remember when Southwest Africa was being fought over, South Africa said, well, you can have, you know, give us the Orange River and you can have the rest of it, because there was no water there, and the water was the key to it. If you start to look around the world, this inequitable distribution occurs virtually everywhere. The only continent on a continental scale that really has only minor areas of shortages is South America, of course dominated by the Amazon and the Great Basin there. But you do have some very interesting dry regions, the Atacama Desert on the western coast of Chile and Peru, northern Chile and southern Peru, one of the driest places on the planet. And, of course, the Mayan that we talked about in the Incas, dealing with those periodic droughts and dealing with water supplies, the Incas, some of the most ingenious aqueduct and water transportation systems anywhere. And then also northeast Brazil, which has periodic, quite nasty droughts. But other than that, South America really doesn't have a water problem. But you can go around each of the continents and identify the dry regions and the wet regions. And, of course, there have been all sorts of schemes throughout history to link up river systems to divert water. I mean, one of the most interesting ones in history, not only for water movement but for transportation, was linking up the Rhine and the Danube. And Charlemagne in 800 AD was the first to start trying to dig that connection. It was finally achieved in the 20th century. And of course, in what was the Soviet Union, now is Russia, diversions of water from the massive river systems flowing north into the Arctic Ocean, the Ob, the Yenisei, and the Lena. and diversions of those waters into the arid southern regions, the dry interior regions of what is now Kazakhstan and those regions. And of course, you had the problem that they had in the Aral Sea, where they were using the water for irrigation, and the sea started to dry up, and the Soviets were dropping soot onto glaciers in the Himalaya Mountains, trying to increase the melt rate to recharge those the Aral Sea and the river systems. So you can go around the world and you can pick out these inequities of distribution. And of course, each of them are potential trouble spots. I mean, one of the things that is going to be a difficulty is when Sudan and Ethiopia start to really develop, they start taking their share of water out of the Nile. What does that do to the downriver country of Egypt? And, of course, Egypt's created some of its own problems by building the Aswan Dam in the hottest part of the country, spread the water out, increase the evaporation rate so that the flow in the down part, down to the delta, which was traditionally the breadbasket of Egypt, the flow of water there has been reduced dramatically. And so you can see these problems, you can identify them, and they are potential trouble spots, and will particularly become the focus as the world starts to get its focus turned to water. There really are no shortages. There are places of inequitable distribution. There are places where you know, people simply shouldn't be there because the water isn't there. And it's certainly one of the problems of the American Southwest, the great migrations to the Sun Belt, and yet completely inadequate water supplies. And and that, of course, goes back to the point I was making earlier, where in North America, or in the United States, I should say, as they went west, it got drier and drier. So the demand for a change in the law got very strident, and they introduced the appropriative or prior rights doctrine. Now, not all of the states adopted it initially, and some still have both. I believe Massachusetts is one of those, has riparian and prior rights. But it also raised some very interesting issues. For example, some of the American Indians in the Southwest, the Navajo and so on, who had been using the Colorado River and its waters and had developed irrigation systems in the dry period around 1000 A.D., and they went to the court and said, we think we've got a prior rights claim here, and showed aerial photographs of their 1,000-year-old irrigation systems. And, of course, that created a lot of consternation. But one of the interesting problems, if you don't think about these things and are not aware of how different water is as a resource, and that's where we need to go with this discussion, because there's a moral component to it, is that both Canada and the United States had the riparian system, and in order to prevent confrontation over water crossing the international boundary, we agreed to what was called the Boundary Waters Treaty. And when that was written, riparian rights were incorporated into it. But of course, when they changed to the prior rights doctrine, they forgot about the Boundary Waters Treaty and left it with the riparian rules. So when there is a dispute over the water, as there was with the Red River of the North in the Minnesota and Manitoba area, they brought in the International Joint Commission, which had a committee of three people, or six people, I should say, three Americans and three Canadians. They ruled in Canada's favor because they had to apply riparian doctrine. Well, of course, to the Americans, they saw their members as traitors. They said, hey, you sold us down the river here, literally. And of course, it was because they'd set up a treaty and agreements and then change the rules on in one of the countries. And of course, that's an issue, and then we need another whole program on this, with North America, because the North American Free Trade Agreement was almost totally about water. We already had 80% free trade, and the only thing really left to negotiate was water. And Canada has approximately one quarter to one third of all the world's fresh water. And in the U.S., it's certainly in the western half. That is, if you draw a line right down through the middle, east of that line, you've got greater than 20 inches of rainfall, and west of it, you've got less than 20 inches, except for that very small portion up in the U.S. Northwest. And you've got a free trade agreement that is primarily about water without the recognition that the philosophical and legal rules in each country are completely different. So that's going to create severe problems, in my opinion, down the road. Now, just to sort of wrap up this little bit, I talked about water. It is completely different than all other resources. And I say that having served on water commissions, and the only meetings I've ever been at, and certainly chaired, that where it got more hostile was over children, schooling, and things like that. I have chaired meetings over water in the Assiniboine River where people have got up in the audience and threatened to shoot bureaucrats and politicians over the water in the river. And I had to say, sir, that's seditious, and I'll call in the Mounties if you don't settle down. And I've had people literally spit in my face because they were told that I was going to rule that allow hazardous waste that might potentially impinge upon their water source. And it wasn't the case at all. It was just a malicious politician that spread that rumor. And then, of course, you see the claims about the Athabasca tar sands and the pollution of the water. And then the Keystone Pipeline was threatening the Ogallala Aquifer. And all of these environmental threats are to the water supply. And, of course, that's done because they know that nothing will agitate people more. Now, beyond that moral issue of water, of course, it goes back to the idea of whether it's a public good or a private good. And those questions are fundamental to the debate that's going on throughout the world right now. That is, what should government control and what should be in private hands? And how much control should the government have? And how much restriction on private ownership of things and use of things. So water puts us right at the heart of all of those much larger debates. Now, I'll just finish up with one last little point here, not necessarily finish up, but just as a pause part, I guess. There have been two major conferences on water in the industrial or business sector. There was one in Milwaukee in 1991, where they were talking. Oppenheimer held a meeting for people with billions of dollars to invest about how to buy up water rights and how to get control of water and so on. And of course, who's sitting at the table but Coca-Cola, getting ready to launch their Dasani water bottled water brand, and Snapple with their soft drinks and so on. That, by the way, is an amusing thing because I remember the U.S. announced that for the first time ever, there was more soft drinks drank than water in the U.S., which, of course, completely ignores the fact that most soft drinks are 99% water, but nonetheless, that's what's wrong with all the thinking about it. And then more recently, in the 2007, I believe it was, there was a meeting in Boston about water, buying water stocks. And it's been shown by several people that if your portfolio over the last 15 years had contained nothing but water-related stocks, that is, water rights or soft drinks or bottled water or technology for water for purification and distribution, that you would have had the best return on your investment of any package of portfolio that you could put together. So from all sorts of angles, the water issue is growing, is vulnerable to becoming a vehicle for the Agenda 21, and is certainly listed as a factor, and has long been at the center of the Club of Rome, which became the Agenda 21, and I'm sure will be a major, major discussion at Rio Plus 20.
Well, Dr. Ball, I mean, that's a mouthful and a half. You've just been an absolute fount of information on this topic. And it, while listening to that, it makes me realize just how little actual knowledge and data I have when it comes to this extremely important topic, which I think goes back to the earlier point that often when these types of topics are explored in a less than thorough way, they can use and exploit our ignorance of the topic to create the alarm or to create to shape the discussion in a way that benefits themselves. But I guess getting back to the fundamental point of this, at least from my perspective, it raises to my mind the question of how do you think this will play out at Rio? What kind of thing will they do to try to shape this discussion? And then how do we counteract that? I mean, what is the real battleground shaping up to be here?
Well, I think the real battleground is shaping up to be the two vehicles that they've used so effectively at the start, anyway, with the climate issue, and that is fear, and of course you can go back to Michael Crichton's wonderful book State of Fear, it was a novel, but it was in three different sections. But it showed how not only the government, but also the extreme environmentalists with a very extreme political agenda exploit that fear. As I said in my comments, water creates more fear than anything, so that will become a factor. The other one is, of course, what you just mentioned, the lack of knowledge, lack of understanding. And of course, it isn't that people are ignorant; they're just not informed about these things. And of course, the problem starts in the education system. And so, somebody once said, "If you think education is expensive, try ignorance." And it's so true with these issues. Now, of course, one of the things that you see going on. And we've seen it in Canada here with the Suzuki getting into the classroom and walking in and welcomed into the classroom and pushing these agendas. And so somehow we've got to anticipate that. We know the procedures that they've used already. And what we need to do is not come after the fact, but to start the education process early and raise, as we're doing here, hopefully, on this program. Yeah, I put out a whole lot of ideas, and, you know, it's always one of the most pleasing comments I get after a presentation is people say, you know, you really made me think. And after I apologize for that, I say, good, that's what I wanted to do. Right? So we know their modus operandi. We know how they do these things. We can anticipate it. We can prepare people for it. And the only thing is, as I said, that the level of emotion with water will be much, much higher. And and of course, it also raises issues about sovereignty, nationalism, transporting water across international boundaries. We get into the issues of pipelines. I've already mentioned there's a proposal, for example, for a massive water pipeline from Alaska down the West Coast into California, been on the books for some time. And then, of course, diversions of rivers and all of these other ideas. And so I think that's a critical thing. The second, or the, well, the next part of it, and I'm going to do the numbering thing like all academics do, but is that there was always a debate about whether scientists should get involved in the political fight. And I saw this on many, many different levels. Many scientists don't want to be involved in the politics of it. They don't want to. They don't see the role. Science, the pure science, should be amoral and apolitical. But I think that in this day and age, with this abuse of ignorance and abuse of science, as we've already seen with the climate issue, you cannot stay out of the fray. And of course, a lot of the persuasion has been done with the funding. When you look at how I talked about Maurice Strong and the funding through the different national agencies, I mean, Canada, for example, Environment Canada, $6.36 billion spent in 5 years on climate change and achieved nothing. But the Friends of Science was a group that I helped set up in Calgary, and of course, they were retired professional scientists and saw what was wrong with the climate science and wanted to do something about it, but had the problem that they were, some of them had worked in the oil patch. All of them lived in Calgary or in southern Alberta, which, of course, is the personification of oil. And so they had strikes against them even before they started. And so the big fight that went on in that group was, you know, we want to stop Kyoto because it's based on false science, but if we don't want to get into the political fight. And so they determined right from the start they would do nothing but the science. Now, they were accused of being paid by the oil companies, and they were accused of trying to sway elections by offering 30-second commercials on radio that, of just simple scientific facts. They won that case, by the way. And so that was always the debate. I don't think we can afford to have that debate this time. I think that we have to recognize that what is going on here is, as Maurice Strong deliberately set it up, the two-pronged IPCC producing the corrupted science that he needed to promote his political agenda through Rio 1992, and that if you're going to battle them head on, you've got to do it in both arenas. You simply cannot. You're not going to win in the pure science debate for the simple reason. And let me sort of almost be a little flippant about this. You know, students used to say to me, well, you know, I'm not very good at sciences, but, you know, do you think I should do a BSc or a BA? And I said, a C average in science is better than an A average in arts. And, of course, they'd look at me, and, you know, how could a professor say that? And I said, go to convocation. What happens? They say, when all of the science degree people stand, and about 40 people get up. And then they say, would all the arts recipients stand, and the whole arena rises. I mean, just in pure logistics, you're going to be better off with a science degree, even if it's not the best. And of course, what that reflects is that the population at large is 80% of an artistic bent and 20% of a science bent. And you can take any group, any university, and 80% will take arts courses and 20% will take science. And, of course, another argument that I used with science is, hey, look, if you go the science route, you can always, and are not coping, you can always switch into arts. You can't go the other way. You can't go the other way. And so one of the things that we've got to acknowledge is that somehow you've got to get the scientific message presented in a way that the non-science people can understand. Now, I've always acknowledged that this is the thing that Gore did so eminently well in his movie. It was pure scientific propaganda, and extremely well done, deserved the Oscar because it was from Hollywood, the land of make-believe. And, of course, people looked at it and couldn't see what was wrong with it. But anybody that knew anything about science could look at it and say, that's absolute rubbish. But, of course, they are the 20% that are filing out of the theater and are going to be drowned out by the 80% who've been completely convinced by the dancing fat man up on the screen. So this is a major issue that we have to confront in our society, because it isn't just information, it's the nature of the information, and so much of it is not only beyond the capability of understanding of people, but far too many of them are far too willing to be proud of the fact that they can't do numbers and they can't do science. And it's the same thing. You'll get people will proudly admit they can't change the spark plugs on their car, but try and get them to admit they can't, you know, push a keyboard or write with a pencil, and they get very, very angry. And these are the things that we need to deal with and understand if we're going to be effective in getting a balanced message and getting all sides of the debate on the table.
Well, I think you're right about that. We always perish for lack of knowledge, so we always need to be as well informed about these things as we can be. And I would love to continue going into this topic and exploring more of the nooks and crannies here, but I think just physically we're running out of time here. So I guess, is there any message or anything that you'd like people to take out of this conversation that summarizes what it is that that really is the key concept here?
Well, I think the key concept is that I think Santayana said that people that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. But he also said historians are greater than God because they can change history and he can't. He forgot about those people at the IPCC that rewrote the history. But I think the lesson of the last 20 years of the green jobs, green economy, one world government, and the complete failure of that is an object lesson that we've got to take in hand and learn from it and then prevent it from happening again, because these people don't give up. Real plus 20 plus or plus 20 is proof of that, and the terms are there, sustainable development, and green economies are persisting, and Kyoto may be dead, but a similar kind of strategy that is seen as more supposedly equitable will replace it. It shouldn't even exist because the science doesn't support it. So hopefully those are the lessons that come out of the last 20 years and come out of the last few minutes that I've been talking about these things.
Excellent. Well, then just to wrap up the conversation, for people who are more interested in following your work on this subject and, of course, many other subjects, and are interested also in supporting your work, tell people how they can find out more.
Well, I have a website, Dr. Timball, drtimball.com, and there are some articles about water on there and a variety of other articles. And of course, one of the themes is that environmentalism is a good new paradigm. The problem is it's been hijacked for politics and a moral high ground. And I talk about that and how I became aware of that and how to deal with that on the website. So and there are links on my website, of course, to some of the other very good websites that provide a wider perspective on things. So hopefully people can benefit from that, and then you and I can do some more programs in the future.
And also, just so that people are aware of it, of course, there's also a donate button to donate to your legal defense fund. Perhaps you'd like to tell people about that.
Oh, yeah, thank you, James. What's happened is that because I'm seen as a threat, because I've known for a long, long time what's been going on and have been speaking out about it, I'm now the receiver of two lawsuits, and there are only two in a series of lawsuits that I've had, but this time I've decided to fight them. But of course, it's enormously expensive, and one of the games in today's society is to use the lawsuit to silence people because they know how expensive it is. So in this case, I'm being sued by two people who are very much involved with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the difficulty I've had, James, is that with most others, they could say he's not qualified. They couldn't say that about me. And so, of course, the fact that I was speaking out meant then that I became the target of the personal attacks paid by the oil companies, which isn't true, and now more latterly the lawsuits. And so I set up the website with a donate button. The money goes directly through PayPal to my lawyer. My lawyer's also got a legal fund set up. The money can go directly to him. So none of it comes to me at all, not a penny. And of course, I want to pursue this because I think that what a lot of people realize, two things. One is freedom of speech, and that's one thing the Americans have got to protect at all costs. And the other is the ability to stand up and use a forum for the truth, which is what our courts have got to be. The courts won't like the idea of having a scientific debate in the courts, but sadly, that's one of the places where it can be dealt with on a purely logical basis. And so that's why I've got the donate button on there, is to help me with the legal costs of fighting the battle.
All right. Well, I certainly hope people will go to drtimball.com, drtimball.com, to check out your work and to support it if they are so inclined. So, Dr. Timball, always an interesting conversation, and I look forward to our next one. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you, James. And yeah, we'll talk about NAFTA and other things around the world about the water issue.